This is Amarins. Hi, everybody. This is Arthur, and I'm a gay American now living in New Zealand. Welcome to episode 61 of the Amarins podcast for Tuesday, December 18th, 2007. 1 week from tomorrow, I'll be heading out on the trip to Chicago, and that means that I won't have an opportunity to record before the Iowa caucuses or the New Hampshire primary. So instead, Jason's joining me today as we sort of do a wrap-up before the big events actually begin. And then after that, I have just a few comments, and then that's it until the Friday episode. So now here's the discussion with Jason. It's now about 16 days to the Iowa caucuses and about 3 weeks to the New Hampshire primaries. So with the festivities about to get underway and the holidays intervening, I thought it was a good time to do a political catch-up. So joining me now is Jason as we carry on with our political discussions. Hello, welcome.
Glad to be back.
So it's getting down to the wire soon.
Yeah, everything's sort of hitting the proverbial fan. We had our, in the middle of this week, I guess, we had our first negative ad brought out by the Romney camp against Mr. Huckabee, which I guess finally shows that he's arrived in the big leagues. And then sort of a little dust-up between the Obama and Clinton campaigns about Obama admitting past drug abuse, or drug use, I should say, not abuse, in a book that he wrote, and sort of, you know, one of those interesting, oh, we're terribly sorry we said it, but not really, type of setups. And also Huckabee's comment about, don't Mormons believe that Satan was Jesus' brother? And, oh, well, that was taken out of context. And so it's good to know that they're stooping to lower levels even earlier in the campaign.
It's a Christmas present for the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Clinton-Obama thing, she has since claimed that it was one of her campaign officials who said that, and didn't he resign or something like that? I can't remember.
Yeah, and you do have to say, you know, this notion of, well, this obviously was planned. You know, there are thousands, if not tens of thousands of people involved in some way, form, or another with the campaign, and the notion that the candidate is going to know what every single person is going to say is, I think, not really very reasonable, but that's not. They moved quickly. You know, she apologized. She distanced herself from it, and the guy left. And now, whether or not this was planned, I don't think anybody will ever know. But again, it's the sort of the immediate notion. Well, it's got to be because everything is just so well oiled and run in the Clinton machine. Well, if that was the case, then she would be beating Mr. Obama's ass all over the place, and she's not. So I things are said. Don't we say things that we don't mean, and it's not some big cabal. It's just sometimes things slip out. You know, these are probably people running on, you know, 5 and 6 hours of sleep a night, and stuff happens.
Yeah, and it's a bit unreasonable to expect the candidate to be responsible for every single thing that every single staffer in every single congressional district or whatever says. Although,
right, and
this was national as far as I can remember.
Well, it was the person who was in charge of, it was in New Hampshire, and I believe it was the husband of the former governor of New Hampshire. So obviously this is kind of up within the organization, but it's not like Huckabee's comments, which came directly from the horse's mouth, and we'll be generous on that one, you know, where you can't say, oh, well, I didn't, you know, it was taken out of context. I didn't mean, and yet again, there still is a little bit of give and take that you gotta give people sometimes.
Absolutely, especially when it's their staffers who are saying this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, speaking first on the Republican side, I suppose, recently Mitt Romney made his speech.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what to call it exactly, but a speech at the George H.W. Bush Library,
mm-hmm.
where
right.
He was supposedly talking about religion and politics, although we only used the word Mormon once.
Right.
What do you make of that, first of all?
Well, before sort of getting specifically into what he said in the speech, which I think a couple of things where you really kind of have to raise your eyebrows at, is the notion from the Republicans, oh, there's no religious tests for running for the presidency. You know, there's no, their person's religion shouldn't matter at all. And yet they appeal to it's sort of an exclusive group of people that are all associated with their religion. And it's sort of like you've got to agree with us on these issues, which are to a great extent, you know, against same-sex marriage, against abortion, against stem cell research, I guess, for creationism. And so you sort of have, I always sort of scratch my head and say, you say this isn't, religion shouldn't play in at all, and yet you are playing directly towards these people's religious beliefs. It's a very large and I think extremely powerful constituency within the Republican Party. I would almost say that it more or less rules the Republican Party. So it's interesting to me that there's all this protestation from, oh, you know, religion doesn't matter, when Romney had to make these speeches to say, I'm one of you. So obviously it does. It does play a part.
Yeah.
It is of importance to Republicans. I mean, can you imagine any Democrat giving a speech like this?
Well, actually, Obama did, of a sort. He had a speech where talking about people of faith and those sorts of things, mm-hmm. and he said that you shouldn't have to check faith at the door. He meant of a place like Congress, for instance.
Right.
And I took exception with that at the time. This is way before he was running for president, mm-hmm. because he seemed to be implying that religious people should be wearing their religion on their sleeves and promoting it in their legislative endeavors. And mm-hmm. especially when you're talking about a legislator, I have a very different view. I think legislators right. have an obligation to keep the religion out of it because they're supposed to be representing all of the constituents, including atheists,
right.
for instance. And that's got to be even more so for a president, I would have thought.
Right. But his comments were sort of in a general context. This is really set for a specific group of people. Because especially with Romney's speech, any non-Christians were certainly, if you read the speech, are certainly not even sort of recognized. You know, there's the freedom requires religion, just as religion requires freedom. Freedom opens the windows of the soul so that man can discover his most profound beliefs and commune with God. Freedom and religion endure together or perish alone. And
which is utter nonsense.
Well, yes, you know, he sort of talked about, you know, the great cathedrals of Europe were all emptied. Well, they have, in most of Europe, pretty thriving democracies, and if he's, I would disagree with the notion that religion is completely gone from there, but we'll take him at his word. How are these then thriving? And then the other thing about, in recent years, the notion of the separation of church and state has been taken by some well beyond its original meaning. They seek to remove from the public domain any acknowledgement of God. Religion is seen as merely a private affair with no place in public life. It is as if they are intent on establishing a new religion in America, the religion of secularism. They are wrong. Well,
that's his opinion.
That's not what secularists want. And again, this is, you know, this notion of, you know, I believe in Jesus Christ, you know, he's the Son of God, this type of stuff. And it was very, several people, you know, sort of the talking heads said it was very exclusionary. It wasn't inclusive. It was very much, here are the beliefs and you have to believe these or you're not a Christian, although they don't say that anymore. They use this people of faith thing.
Yeah, but so by the which next they mean Christian.
Right, the next generation of the Falwells and the Robertsons. There's this guy who runs some mega church out in Colorado, and he talks about people of faith. And it's just like, well, that implies, of course, that if you don't believe according to what he believes, then somehow you're not a person of faith. And
yes.
This was, to me, sort of the same same sort of comments. And then another thing which I thought was somewhat ironic was talking about when Romney talked about, this is what I believe and I'm not going to compromise my principles or my beliefs, and it's just like, whoa, unlike practically every other position you have. So it was interesting. What I think the most interesting thing about it was an interesting speech, and there was, you know, a day or so of press, you know, because people were saying, well, now Huckabee's name wasn't mentioned. And then it just, like, went away. And I don't see how, you know, there was a comment at the end of one of the stories. They interviewed somebody and says, and his quote was, I'm paraphrasing, but essentially, like, well, Romney was trying to pass himself off as a Christian, and he's not. So I don't quite know how this has helped him. if you have questions about him, about Romney, about Mormonism, about his faith and all that, I don't see how that resolves your question when you now have an alternative.
Yeah.
If Huckabee was not in the race, then I think they would say, okay, we can't vote for Giuliani. We don't like McCain. Thompson, you know, seems kind of...
loopy.
Well, loopy and suspect. And so who else is there but Romney, who is at least talking the talk and trying to walk the walk? Well, with Huckabee, you're there.
Yeah. Well, when I heard about this, what it actually struck me as was kind of a lame attempt at dog whistle politics, where he was saying something that ordinary normal voters couldn't hear, but he was actually trying to talk to the Red Meat Brigade and the radical right of the Christian side, trying to say, hey, I'm one of you, and all that kind of thing. And
right.
it seemed to me that what he was really saying is, look at me, don't look at Huckabee, ignore the man behind the curtain, I'm the real thing, and all this. But by only mentioning the word Mormon once, which I think was actually part of that strategy, was to try to ignore it
yes.
so that he could
right.
pass himself off as a fundamentalist Christian. By only mentioning the word Mormon once, he didn't convince anybody of anything. And
I think that's true. But also, where does say he gets the nomination? I think this speech can be picked apart by, okay, what do you mean by this? Can people who aren't of atheists or agnostics or anyone who's not within the realm of Christianity or what you sort of say is Christianity, are they patriots? Do they believe in freedom? Do they, you know, I think there are possibilities for huge problems with this.
Well, it amounts to, and you were touching on this before, it amounts to a de facto religious test for public office.
Yeah.
Because you have to be not just a believer in some sort of deity, and not just a Christian, but a fundamentalist Christian as well, a mm-hmm. so-called person of faith, in order to be considered to be president. And that's wrong on so many levels.
Well, that was I'm sure that was the reason the line of, you know, I believe that Jesus Christ is I accept him as my Savior and he's the Son of God, I'm sure that was a pitch towards the right. I mean,
yeah.
not saying that the more secular or the more liberal or the more moderate Christian denominations don't believe that as well, but that was the only thing he didn't say was that I'm born again, which of course doesn't happen in the Mormon faith, I guess. So.
I don't think so. Well, while he's trying to flail around on the right to try to make himself acceptable to the fundamentalist Christians, there is a real fundamentalist Christian who is in the race as well, of course, and that's Huckabee.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he, of course, was in the news just recently when an older speech of his came out where he called for the quarantine of people with HIV. Not necessarily AIDS, as I understand it. And he was given the opportunity to revise his statement.
Well, I've got it here. 1992, made while running for the U.S. Senate. If the federal government is truly serious about doing something with the AIDS virus, we need to take steps that would isolate the carriers of this plague, he wrote in response to an Associated Press questionnaire at the time. It is difficult to understand the public policy towards AIDS. It is the first time in the history of civilization in which the carriers of a genuine plague have not been isolated from the, hold on, I have to turn the page here, general population, and in which this deadly disease for which there is no cure is being treated as a civil rights issue instead of the true health crisis it represents. And then he was asked on this on Fox News Sunday, and he says, in the late 80s and early 90s, we didn't know as much as we do now about AIDS. And responses then were governed more out of political correctness than normal public health protocols. He also noted that he didn't say that we should quarantine, but instead observed that health officials didn't isolate the carrier. Now, would I say things a little differently in 2007? He said, probably so. I'm not going to recant or retract from the statement that I did make because, again, the point was not saying we ought to lock people up who have HIV/AIDS, which I think that's more or less what it's calling for. But the problem with that is, in something that was in one of the things that was pointed out, I can find it.
Well, while you're looking for that, this was a battle that
we fought 20 years ago. Well, yeah, but also the notion in 1992, by 1992, they did know some of the things that he
yes.
talked about the, how it was, you know, it says it was not, like you could understand the statement if it was 1985 or 82
yeah.
or something like that, but we...
By 92, it was known that casual transmission was impossible.
Right. Here's a quote from a person from Log Cabin's healthcare policy advisor. We knew a great deal about HIV and AIDS by 1992, certainly enough to know there was no need to isolate those who were infected. So I think it's a bit, again, he's pandering or playing to his base.
Yeah. But by the same token, and he's also had really incredibly negative things to say about gay people generally, but he also has indicated that he's not necessarily opposed to civil unions, and I can't see how that can actually be the case. I can't remember where I read that, unfortunately, or I would have looked into that a little bit further. Because it would seem to me that he...
I think he's not the notion of states being able to do what they want to do.
Well, and that's fair enough. That's actually a core Republican principle, is to allow states to run their own affairs. Or it always used to be a core Republican principle up until Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. And after that time, it all started changing, so they started federalizing everything and taking away the rights of the states to decide for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have so many of these Republican presidential candidates who are tripping all over themselves to back a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage.
Well,
when it should be left
morality.
Up to the states.
Yeah, they want to legislate morality. There's a big, long...
Yeah.
You know, I find it very interesting that the Party for Small Government wants to amend the Constitution to death, you know.
Yeah.
Gay marriage.
Flag burning.
Affirmative action. Flag burning. Busing.
Yeah.
Abortion.
Yeah. Yeah, they certainly have strayed far from the old Republican principles prior to Ronald Reagan. And even to a certain extent during Ronald Reagan's years, a lot of the people he brought in with him were nutcases, but he himself wouldn't have been backing half of these measures, I don't think.
No, he wouldn't have. I often wonder how different the Republican Party would have been if he hadn't gotten Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
If he'd been active and involved in it up to the end of his life, I think it would have been different.
But Huckabee, go ahead.
He was never mean or vindictive.
No.
You know, he had his beliefs, but it wasn't like if you were opposed to him, you weren't the enemy.
Yeah.
Anyway, go on.
Yeah, which is, of course, part and parcel of the current administration's way of doing things. Well, Huckabee isn't, of course, just a social conservative. He's also a fiscal conservative, which for some people, when they hear those terms, they may think, well, that's all right, because they think low taxes, low regulation. But he's got some odd proposals, doesn't he?
He has what is called the fair tax. And what it would do would essentially, the IRS would come to an end. All federal income taxes, payroll taxes, including Social Security and Medicare taxes, corporate taxes, capital gain taxes, gift taxes, and estate taxes, would be replaced with a national retail sales tax to be levied once at the point of purchase on new goods and services. I'm reading this for something that I got from Wikipedia. And then the proposal also calls for a monthly payment to households of citizens and legal residence aliens based on family size as an advanced rebate of the tax on the purchases people would make. And there's a big sort of debate. They're talking, well, it would be 23%, but no, really, it would be 30%. And then they go, there's all sorts of charming little math stuff, which I don't understand at all. But, I mean, let's think about it. Think about how this would change things. Think about buying a house. Think about buying a $200,000 house and having a 23% tax above and beyond the cost of the house.
Hmm.
I mean, that's $46,000, and if it's what critics of the fair tax plan call, it would be closer to 30%, then that's $60,000, and that's going to impact how much house you can afford.
Yeah.
You know, and it's this notion of, well, you know, rich people would be paying, you know, all sorts of money. That's been disputed. One of the things that I found, Huckabee is proposing a consumption tax. Instead of paying taxes on what you earn, you would pay on what you spend. Huckabee would abolish virtually all federal taxes, the things that we mentioned. And then someone who is a spokesman for this fair tax thing says the IRS would be abolished. April 15th would become just another nice spring day. And then someone says, then this is from a NPR article on December 16th, but could the plan really work? The answer is no, says Bill Gale, director of economic studies at the Brookings Institute. There is an arithmetic problem, there is a political problem, and there is an enforcement problem. Gale says that the way the proposal is presented is misleading. The way the tax is calculated, Gale says, means it would be 30 cents on the dollar, not 23 cents. Dale also asked whether Americans would accept a tax on everything from retail sales to home purchases to health insurance. If enacted, there would be political pressure to create a series of exemptions, which could push the 30 cent rate even higher.
When the right wing pushes taxes like this, and also flat tax to a lesser extent, what they always keep saying is that the rich will pay more in tax because they have higher incomes, and they spend more, so therefore they'll be paying more in tax, as if that somehow makes it good or better. What they always leave out of the equation is the fact that poorer people pay disproportionately higher taxes.
Right.
Because they can't avoid consumption. They can't say, right, oh, I'm going to go to Europe for 6 months or whatever. They still have to buy their food. They still have to buy their medicine. They still have to buy their fuel, all of those kinds of things. And 23 cents or 30 cents out of the dollar for a poor person hurts a hell of a lot more than it does for 30 cents out of the dollar on a billionaire.
Say. Well, that's true. And also the way in which they earn money would be a huge amount of the money would be exempt. And also, oh, yes, on item for item, they would be paying, you would get more money from rich people because they spend more. But it would be like they would have abilities. In the end, it wouldn't be like, oh, you're like a poor person's being taxed 23% and a rich person's being taxed 23%. And to be totally honest, the rich person makes many, many, many times more money than the poor person or the moderate income person. Why shouldn't they pay more in taxes?
Well, that's always been the assumption behind the tax structure as it is, that poor people need more assistance, and also it helps give them a way of getting to the next tax level and so on. You know, it encourages growth and encourages striving in things, whereas a flat tax discourages you because it keeps hitting you harder. And same with consumption taxes. But one of the things about that fascinates me about this whole consumption tax business is they talk about things like rebates, you know, giving people, basically, essentially giving people their money back based on their families. But that's at the end of the process. The same thing has been suggested as a way of handling health insurance, that people be given credits, given refunds to pay for private health insurance. That was one of Bush's proposals, for instance.
$2,500. I'm a person working at minimum wage, I don't have the ability to put forth $2,500.
Exactly.
You know, you would have to, if this were to work, you would have to have a rebate before it went into effect.
Yes.
Or else people who would supposedly be getting the rebate would always be a month behind.
Well, yeah, and it's all well and good to say we'll give you a rebate at the end of the year for the money you've spent or the money you've spent buying health insurance, but if you don't have the money in the first place, what good is a rebate going to do you?
At least with this, the rebate would be each month.
That would be some progress.
But I'm just thinking about how well this would be run, how much fraud would be involved.
Yeah.
Do people in that are low income, do they have checking accounts? Do they have a way for this stuff to be directly deposited? Because that would be the way to go, or else there's just a whole, you know.
Yeah, and it encourages off-the-books transactions, because if you can do something privately with the person and there's no record of it, then you don't have to pay the tax on it. It encourages a black market economy and widespread fraud, as you say, and things like that. I can't see how it could possibly work. I just can't see it.
Well, this is also interesting. It says economist William Gale analyzed a national sales tax, and although it says it's different from the fair tax in several respects, and reported that overall tax burden on middle-income Americans would increase while the tax burden on the very rich would drop, which compared personal income and sort of goes on from there. I also think it would be, how do you fund Medicare? How do you fund Social Security? What if the thing that I have to say, whether you're either side that you fall on this issue, if the proponents of it, what they put forward, what if it doesn't work?
Yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah.
It's this whole notion of, we'll cut taxes, you know, for the rich, and then, you know, we'll have a deficit, but we'll grow out of it. All we need is like 3%, 4% revenue, and by year X, 10 years down the line, we'll be out of it. Well, not being pro or con to the tax or, you know, the cut in taxes, what if that doesn't happen? what has just sort of happened over and over in politics is like, oh, you pay too much taxes, so no, the IRS is bad, and there's no one questions about, well, how does this work? How what happens? The classic example is in the state of Virginia, they had a tax. It was a car tax. And you know, there was some mathematical formula that you paid a certain percentage of the worth of your car each year. And people hated this. They hated it. And so this Republican ran, and he says, well, I'm going to repeal the car tax, and we're just going to get rid of it. And, oh, everybody, you know, and he got elected on, it was one of the reasons he got elected, and they passed this law, and money from the car tax went to local jurisdictions. The things he said that would replace the amount of money that the car tax generated didn't happen, as most of the people, opponents of repealing it and just sort of people in general looking at this guy's, the governor's plan, said this would not happen. And all of a sudden, to make up for the shortfalls of, you know, localities and counties and cities and towns of not getting this money from the state government, they raised taxes. And guess what? People cried out like stuck pigs. Well, no one said, well, this doesn't add up.
Yeah.
And that's the same way with this. You know, oh, it's Americans really are not undertaxed, you know, or I'm sorry, overtaxed. I would say that we're probably undertaxed. But again, over and over again, you know, oh, taxes are bad and we're going to repeal. Well, but yet no one wants to, you know, somebody's pork is somebody else's bacon.
Yes.
And, yeah, you know, you have these things. Oh, it's the bridge to nowhere and the road to this and the peanut museum. Well, these are things that people can find, and they're silly and stupid. But the notion that, oh, we should get rid of farm subsidies, or you know, oh, the way we'll balance the budget is we'll just cut funds to Head Start.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, at some point in time, these are going to cut into programs that people really care about. And there is, you know, it's like Republicans in the 80s always talked about, well, you know, we can save all this money on waste in the government. And sure, there's waste in the government. There's waste in every huge, gigantic organization.
Yeah.
But the amount of waste they were going to find was just totally unrealistic.
Yeah. Not without cutting into, as you say, programs that people actually care about.
Right.
Well, all
and
of this,
if you're
of
willing
course
to make that sacrifice, then you've got to make that sacrifice. And that, yeah, needs to be plainly said to people.
Well, all of which is playing out now in the campaign one way or another, not just on taxes, mm-hmm, but all the other issues that
right,
people are raising. And, of course, as we're getting down there, there's all sorts of flurries of polls and things going on. Do you have any more recent numbers about how things are standing in Iowa at the moment?
This is something called presidentialpolls2008.com, and the most recent Iowa one, which is from the 12th, they have a whole bunch of them. Huckabee is at like 31%, Romney's at 22%. On the Democratic side, Obama's at 33%, that's way up. Clinton's at 24%, Edwards is at 24%. And the Hotline poll has Huckabee at 30%, this is from December 10th, Huckabee at 36%, Romney at 23%, Giuliani at 12%. And the Hotline poll on the Democratic side is essentially, it's a dead heat. And then Clinton at 27%, Obama at 27%, Edwards at 22%, and it sort of goes on. And Newsweek poll, Huckabee at 39%, Romney at 17%, Thompson at 10%, Giuliani at 9%. That seems a bit high. And Newsweek poll, Obama's at 35%, Clinton's at 29%, Edwards is at 18%, and again, they don't really have this plus or minus, and it's big, long, it's just poll after poll after poll that's been conducted, and you can sort of pick your state. Again, the thing that I think people have to realize is that a caucus isn't like, you know, a primary where you can spend half an hour and you just vote. This is an evening.
Yeah.
This is a very public declaration of who you're voting for.
And it's something that a lot of people don't want to participate in because of that.
Right, and it's in front of your neighbors and in front of your friends, or maybe not your friends.
Yeah.
and then there are, I think this only happens for the Democrats, but if you have to, your candidate, whoever he or she might be, has to reach a certain threshold, and I want to say it's like 10 or 15% in order for them to be awarded delegates. And, of course, this is also the first phase in awarding delegates. There are additional phases. This is sort of at the precinct level, and then you sort of move up, not that the number, the delegate selection would change all that much. But if you don't get the threshold, then you have a time frame in which to sort of caucus with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's I'm assuming that like the Biden people and the Dodd people and the Kucinich people, the two or three that show up or whatever, or people lower this, and so there's going to be someone from the Obama campaign, oh, you know, come over to us, and then there's going to be somebody from the Edwards campaign and the Clinton campaign, and so then you sort of, it can take, you know, 3 or 4 hours to do. And the talking heads have sort of been talking about, well, you know, well, so-and-so won Iowa, and they didn't go on and do well, and it's a different animal than a primary.
Well, it's also, the whole campaign is different now than it used to be as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, everything is front-loaded, and February 6th, will everyone have buyer's remorse when they go, oh, my God, that's...
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Illinois primary is coming up fairly soon as well, and at this stage, I have no idea who I'm going to vote for. I mean, apart from it being a Democrat, of course, because I vote in the Democratic primary, but I have no idea who it's going to be. Because I don't really like any of them, truth be known. There's something I don't like about every single candidate.
Well, let me see how people in Illinois, according to the Chicago Tribune WGN-TV poll conducted by Market Shares Corporation for the 11th of December shows, and this comes as a huge shock, Barack Obama is at 50%. Clinton's at 25, Edwards is at 7. In the Republican side, it's Giuliani at 23, Huckabee at 21, Romney at 14, McCain at 12. Mm. So does it say, I think that's part of the big day, isn't it? Isn't that February 5th?
Yeah.
So there, you know, it's, a lot can happen. You know, there's, what, 5 days between, you know, Iowa and New Hampshire, which seems like a really, really short time, but a lot can happen in 5 days. And then I think the next really major contest is South Carolina poll.
Well, so, unless the rules have changed, and I don't know, they could have, because I haven't voted in a presidential primary in Illinois in a while. But the way it always used to be is there was what they called the beauty contest, which is the one that you wanted to see as the nominee, but you had to vote for the delegates separately by congressional district.
I don't think they do that anymore.
I would hope not, because it was horribly complicated.
Yes. And, well, what's interesting is, I don't know if it's in Illinois. I know New Hampshire, independents can just decide, well, oh, I'm going to vote in the Republican primary. Oh, I'm going to vote in the Democratic primary. So, and then also we can do more numbers, because this is what the media loves to do, and we should mimic the media because we all love them. The Fox News Opinion Dynamics poll for 12/12/2007 in New Hampshire has Romney at 33%, McCain at 20, Giuliani at 16, Huckabee at 11. On the Democratic side, it's 34 for Clinton, 25 for Obama, 15 for Edwards. And, of course, one of the problems, I think, with Romney is if he doesn't do well in Iowa, he really has to do well in New Hampshire. And he really has to do well. You know, he has to end up, like, 13 points or have a large lead over whoever might come in second, because he's a former governor of the state of Massachusetts, and he's sort of a home field advantage in a way.
Yeah.
And so you would think he would just be able to do really, really well, because we can remember back to 1980, George Bush won Massachusetts, but John Anderson got all the press because he came in so close, such a close second.
Yeah.
You know, so that's perception, you know, and the perception is huge. Romney isn't over with. He has a huge amount of money, his own mostly, but a huge amount of money, and but he's got to get traction somewhere. I think you could, if New Hampshire's close enough, you could sort of just discount it by saying, well, he should have done well there.
Yeah.
It's Massachusetts is right next door.
Well, in a little over 2 weeks, this will all start becoming clear. Then in 3 weeks to the New Hampshire primary, it'll become clearer still. And so on, up until the end.
Right. Then there's Nevada, South Carolina, and then there's the disputed. There's like Florida and Michigan or somewhere in there for the Republicans, but not for the Democrats. And that's just too complicated to deal with right now.
Yeah, that'll get sorted out eventually. Because we probably won't have a chance to go over all of this again. In fact, I know we won't until after New Hampshire, which is...
Yeah, you'll be here. You'll be in the United States when Iowa happens.
Yes, I will. So I'll be able to watch it live, although I would hear, too, of course, on CNN or something. But yes, I'll be here. I'll be in the U.S. when it's happening.
You'd be a stone's throw away from the state as opposed to half a world away.
Yeah, I could drive to Iowa if I wanted to. Why I'd want to, I don't know, but I could.
Yes.
That's not a slam against
Not,
Iowa. It's just
no,
that
it would be January 3rd, and that would be a good reason to stay warm someplace in
Exactly.
Colorado for that.
Exactly. My thinking precisely. Oh, well, we'll see. Yeah, so we'll plan another political thing after New Hampshire, which is February 2nd. No,
No, January 8th.
that's what I meant. God, looking at my wrong place in my little list of paper in front of me. Never mind me. January 8th. After that's done and dusted, then we'll have another one. The thing is that I don't actually get back into New Zealand until the next day. Well, actually, I suppose it's no. Actually, technically, it is the 8th in America. The time change always throws me off. I get here on the 9th, but it's the 8th in the U.S. still when I get in. So I don't know.
Well, we can talk after the dust settles.
Yeah, what we may do is shoot for that Friday, but we'll see how we go. We'll sort something out.
Yes.
But thanks again for joining me. It's always fun to talk about all this stuff.
Yes. Always enjoyable. Always fun.
Yeah. Well, thanks again. There you have it. That's the last political episode till after the holidays. Actually, that's my second to last podcast of any kind until after the holidays, but that's a whole other issue. I'll talk about that more on Friday. But I'd just like to thank Jason again for joining me today, and you can find his blog at jasonsviewfromdc.blogspot.com, and there is a link on my site, of course. And the last thing I want to do today is just go over a couple of comments. And first up was John Q. Public, who said, "Sorry to hear you and Nigel will be separated during the vacation. I wonder if you will have culture shock coming back to the States. It'll be interesting to hear your comments after your visit." And I said, "Yes, the thing I don't like is being separated. This will be the longest we've been apart in 12 years. I fully expect to have at least some culture shock, but I'm hoping not too much. In any event, I'm taking my digital recorder with me in the hope that I can record some audio while I'm there." And it is actually this separation that I don't like, although I feel better knowing that Nigel's here because his family's around and keep him entertained. And I would find it much harder if I was here for 2 weeks and he was overseas. But maybe that's just me, I don't know. But I do hope to record some audio while I'm in the U.S. I don't know if I'll be able to, but I hope to at least try. And who knows, I might even be able to post a Rode podcast while I'm out. But speaking of audio, I do have an audio comment to play for you now, and here it is.
"Hey, this is Jason in Washington, D.C. I just wanted to say what a great public service announcement for all of us searching for what to give to podcasters. It was truly a great and wonderful idea, and I will be going to iTunes and doing that right away. You have just so incredibly simplified my Christmas. I'm just thanking you so much. Talk to you later. Bye."
Thanks for that, Jason. He, of course, remembers that when I was younger, I used to make pretend commercials all the time. Of course, my equipment was much more primitive, and I had no software. It was all done with tape recorder and a microphone. But I remember I did one for the Encyclopedia of Ants and the Urban Guerrilla Warfare Technological Institute. Those are the two that come to mind. I might still have them on tape somewhere. I should see if I can dig them up. Or then again, maybe not. But at any rate, in case any of you missed it, I'm going to play that pretend commercial is the last thing today, and then that's it for today, and I will be back again on Friday. Leave a comment on my blog, amrins.com, or you can send an email to me at amrins@yahoo.com, or you can call my U.S. listener line on 206-339-8413. But that's it for today, and I will be back again on Friday. Have a great rest of the week, everybody. Bye. Yes, Christmas is almost here, and time's running out to get that perfect gift for your favorite podcasters. If you're anything like me, you've been racking your brain trying to come up with a gift for the people who work so hard to bring you information, entertainment, or a total waste of time. Well, there is a perfect gift, and it won't cost you anything. Leave a 5-star review on iTunes, and you'll help raise the rankings of your favorite podcasts. Your review will show up in the iTunes store for the country you live in, so your favorite podcasters can have reviews all over the world. How great is that? No time to write a review? Don't want to? Don't worry. Just check out the 5-star reviews your favorite podcasters already have and click yes to the question, "Was this review helpful?" That'll help your podcasters too. Podcasters give us so much. This is our chance to give something back.